dark or cool during the morning hours, then a slight chance of some rain in the afternoon. Otherwise, it'll be a partly sunny Tuesday with a high near 75. Expanded forecast, remaining warm through the weekend with highs around 80, scattered showers and storms. Right now, sunshine and 56. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up. Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg.
I am truly pleased and honored to be speaking once again with best-selling author Ralph Peters, who is quite well known for the superb novels that he has crafted that spring out of the horrific war between the states, the American Civil War that tore this country apart in so many ways, and in a whole lot of respects, the pain of that conflict is still not fully healed all these years later. His most recent novel about the Civil War takes us to the dramatic final days of that conflict when Confederate General Robert E. Lee was making one last desperate attempt to hold the line and stave off surrender to the Union Army. It is a story replete with all kinds of incredible sub-stories of all kinds of memorable characters caught in the crosshairs of this bitter war. And Ralph Peters tells all these stories with the skill of a masterful storyteller. The book is published by Forge, a division of Tom Doherty. Again, it's called Judgment at Appomattox. Ralph Peters, we welcome you back to the Morning Show.
Well, thanks so much for having me back. I truly appreciate it.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. Ahead of us talking very specifically about this novel, I think it would be interesting to talk for a moment about sort of the special drama that is involved in the final moments of any kind of a conflict. I'm thinking, for instance, of America's final hours in Vietnam, or I'm thinking about Hitler's desperate last stand in the Second World War. As someone who's just written a book about the final days of the Civil War, what can you tell us about sort of the special drama that is involved in these kind of stories, whatever the specific context of them might be?
Well, they do all have their own context. And the one portrayed in Judgment at Appomattox, where Lee is finally forced to surrender the Army of Northern Virginia to Grant, it's especially dramatic because this was our most brutal and bitter war. 740,000 Americans dead. And by the way, more than half of them died not of wounds but of disease. And the primary disease was dysentery, aggravated diarrhea. Camp sanitation wasn't good. And I'll tell you, you wouldn't want to go camping with these guys. Those armies didn't smell well. But in the final 2 weeks of the war, which is what I cover in Judgment at Appomattox, you have Lee, who's been pinned against Petersburg and Richmond. And he makes a desperate attempt to beat Grant one last time at Fort Stedman. It fails. His siege lines are penetrated. Everything starts collapsing for Lee. In the dead of night, he manages to get to escape with his army through a very narrow open window. And then the chase is on. And it's a chase across the countryside of southern Virginia with battles or extensive skirmishes every single day. Lee's desperate army, which hasn't been fed in days, struggling to break away and get to North Carolina and unite with one other Confederate army that's surviving. And Grant and his very aggressive lieutenants, they are very determined to stop him. And as you pointed out in your introduction, your generous introduction, Greg, really the drama is the human drama. I mean, the battles are all there, and the battles, obviously, they're exciting because battles are. But for me, the real drama is the human side of this. I mean, John Brown Gordon, a brilliant Southern general, is forced to leave his wife behind when the army leaves Petersburg. She's in Petersburg. She's just had a baby the day before it all collapses. And so I really try to stick strictly to the historical record. The only thing that makes this fiction is that I'm imagining the inner lives and thoughts of these people and their motivations, because I want people to understand that we don't understand the Civil War. We think we do. We don't. We don't get it in schools. Hollywood is absolutely perverted with the way they portray it. It wasn't all that beautiful romance with flouncy dresses and men in spotless uniforms. It was a tough, muddy, ugly, bloody war. And it's complex on both sides. And I think that's especially relevant today, where we want to simplify things. We want to make it, no pun intended, black and white. We want to make it, you know, the South, they were all bad guys, and the North were all good guys because they were fighting to end slavery. It was just vastly more complicated than that. And I try to, when I write, I don't have a bias. Although my background is as a Yankee, my Civil War ancestor wore Union Blue and died because of it. But when I'm writing these books, I try to understand the men and women on their own terms, in the terms of their times, not what makes a man or a woman a good man in 2017, but what constituted a man or woman of civic virtue in 1861 or 1865. So it involves not just a lifetime, literally a lifetime for me since childhood, of researching the war itself, informed by my own military experience, but also you've got to read the literature of the times. What music did these people listen to? What theatrical events? What was culture? What did they learn and what did they study in school? It was, in fact, the Civil War generation was amazingly literate. And not just the officers. They left behind incredible diaries, letters home, memoirs, and they run the full gamut. Some are just beautifully written, much more so than you'd see in an email exchange today. While others, with some of the junior enlisted men who aren't so well educated, when they're writing home to their brothers or their male friends, it's astonishing how many ways you can misspell a four-letter word. But they're human beings, and that's my bottom line in this. Understand our history in human terms. Don't rush to judgment before you know the facts. And in all these books, and in the current one, Judgment at Appomattox, I'm just trying to give Americans an honest feel for their history.
Hmm. I think you really do a tremendous job of bringing these people alive as full-fledged human beings. And, of course, in our minds, we know that, of course, all of these were human beings, just like us, living in a different time, and of course, living through desperate circumstances. But people. But then you give us these little details along the way that reinforce that in all kinds of ways. Such as one of the first times in your novel that we meet Robert E. Lee, and where he is at this point in time. He is annoyed by all kinds of flea bites on his ankles. And
yes,
it's just so interesting to think about Robert E. Lee being somebody itching his ankles because of the fleas that are biting him. And it's telling little details like that, and your novel is full of them, that I think bring this story alive to us in a way that it would not be if this were, for instance, a work of nonfiction.
And that's the truth. The basic thing is people love stories. Humanize it. They need to know the facts, but what's the human truth behind those facts? And Robert E. Lee is a very good example. We think we know him, but we just see the man in the statues or in the photographs when he's old and gray at the end of the war and suffering from angina, digestive problems, rheumatism. But what don't we know about Robert E. Lee? Well, we picture him as a Virginia aristocrat, which he sort of was. The Lee family was a great family, but he's from the black sheep side of it. His father, the Revolutionary War hero, Light Horse Harry Lee, gets into all sorts of financial scandals and scams. He cheats people. He flees the country, leaving his wife and children behind in Alexandria. Robert E. Lee grows up in not-so-genteel poverty. In the summer, he gets to visit the great estates of his cousins, the plantations, but he's always at the bottom of the table. He's not fully welcome. There's always a cloud. And he spends his whole adult life trying to rebuild his branch of the family's reputation to construct himself as the perfect Regency gentleman. And again, we see pictures of him as old. He was an incredibly handsome man, a brilliant officer, who went to West Point because it was a free education. He's a brilliant officer. He's dashing, has a very good marriage, but he's a flirt. His wife lives with it. He doesn't cheat on her, not at all. He loves to dance and flirt, and he loves parties, and that's not how we think of them. And then you get to the Civil War. Lee was adamantly against secession, adamantly so. He was still wearing Union blue on the eve of the war, and he didn't want the country to come apart. But when Virginia seceded, he felt he couldn't fight against his own family, his own neighbors, his own state, because American identity was very different in the mid-19th century. In the North, there's already a pretty strong sense of national identity, but in the South, it's still very feudal, and people identify themselves as not an American, but I'm a Virginian, or I'm a Mississippian, or I'm a Georgian. It's just different. And then at the end of the war, when you're in Judgment and Appomattox, when you're talking about him having flea bites on his ankles and scratching them in his boots, he is a man, in these last 2 weeks of the war, when he's trying to rescue his army and escape Ulysses S. Grant's noose, it could have been a literal noose, because Lee doesn't know if he and his sons who went to West Point, his nephew who went to West Point, they're all generals in the Confederate Army. He doesn't know if they will be tried for treason and hanged. So, I mean, this is as personal as it gets. And when it gets to Appomattox, and Lee is surrounded and finally forced to surrender after two brutal weeks of constant marching and fighting, Grant, in one of the most magnanimous acts of American history, and Grant has a telepathic communication with Lincoln. They both know you can't punish the South anymore. It's been devastated. We've got to reunite the country. We need reconciliation. And Grant offers Lee, when he meets Lee, he offers him surrender terms that are just stunningly generous to Lee. All the Southern soldiers and officers, they'll be paroled and guaranteed that if they return to their homes in peace, they will not be molested by the federal government. The soldiers who, claim, in the Southern military, often the artillerymen and cavalrymen had their own horses. They were allowed to keep their horses. Officers could keep their sidearms. Just a very important point of pride, though that sounds small to us today. And so Grant did and he fed them. Grant fed them. They were hungry, and he fed them. And it's just the human side of that. And Grant is funny because Grant is the great strategist. Lee's a brilliant tactician. Grant turns out to be a poor tactician but a great strategist. And Lee can't remember Grant from the Mexican War because Grant was just a lieutenant, nondescript quartermaster. And for Grant, Lee was the hero. Everybody in the war with Mexico looked up to Lee as the dashing, stunning star, Winfield Scott's pet. And when they meet at Appomattox, it's the first time Robert E. Lee can remember seeing Grant. And for Grant, he's meeting his former idol. And that's the human side of this as well. So those are the things I'm trying to capture. And just as a sidelight, Greg, the great tragedy for the South beyond the war itself is that John Wilkes Booth thinks he's defending the South, and he shoots Abraham Lincoln, who wanted reconciliation, who had a vision of mercy and lifting people up, not tearing them down. And so then we had mismanaged Reconstruction and everything else that happened. And after the war, it's interesting, you know, granted, guaranteed, you know, put his name to it, these Southern officers were all to go home and not be molested by the government. Andrew Jackson, about a year after the war, wanted to arrest Lee and try him for treason. And Grant, who's the most popular man in the country now that Lincoln's dead, he throws a tantrum. And he lets President Johnson know that if you do that, I will resign and I will do it publicly and I will fight you in every way I can. And as a result of which, Johnson backs off and Lee is allowed to have his last few years of ill health as president of Washington University, today Washington and Lee University. And so there's so much we don't know about the human side. And it just, when we simplify history, it's very, very dangerous.
Right. So much is lost. I appreciate the rich portraits that you draw. I want to read one paragraph. This is towards the end of the book. This is as General Grant is making his way to Appomattox for the dramatic moment of surrender. Grant warmed himself not to be smug. He commanded himself to be flawlessly polite. Not one breath would embarrass Lee, let alone humiliate him. He'd already formulated the surrender terms in his head, striving to be a Lincoln man, to fit military requirements to the president's intentions. If Lee was not unreasonable, they would finish things without further ill feeling. So it's very important for us to understand that connection between General Grant and President Lincoln and how that helped shape the way in which surrender occurred. I want to take a moment and have you talk about what I think is one of the most fascinating facets of this book, namely what some of these generals and other officers were like, and how in many respects they proved to be some of the most sort of complicated factors in this. At some point you have somebody saying, I think General Grant thinking to himself, leading generals was a good sight harder than leading honest soldiers. Talk for a moment about some of these complicated human beings on both sides and what a challenge that they often presented.
Well, and it was on both sides. And throughout the war, Confederate generals, you know, the Southerners have this aristocratic pride among the senior generals, even those who aren't aristocrats. And they're always trying to court-martial each other. And, you know, when everything goes wrong in a battle, they've got to blame each other. And it's pretty petty, but it's very human. On the northern side, you have overt jealousies and politicking. And Grant, you know, Grant is the guy who makes it on sheer talent. And, you know, others like Phil Sheridan, Grant's protege. Phil Sheridan is a brilliant battlefield fighter. He is relentless. He knows how to win battles. But he also sticks it to his colleagues. He knows Sherman and Grant are going to be the most memorable heroes of the war. But he wants to be number three. And he does the best he can to push everybody else, George Gordon, Meade, or anyone else, out of the way. And when he gets a chance, he sticks to his fellow Union generals, those who might be seen as competitors. At the same time, he's extremely supportive of and generous to his subordinates. He wants their loyalty. He wants them on his side in these struggles. Very complicated human being. Or you get someone like George Armstrong Custer, who we remember from the Little Bighorn. In the Civil War, he's a general officer of cavalry in his early to mid-20s, and he's brilliant. Just a brilliant young soldier, and also, by the way, just about a psychopath. This guy loves war. And you have others who, Grant doesn't love war, but he sees what has to be done. And Custer on the battlefield is a savage, yet afterward, when he takes Confederate generals prisoner at Sailor's Creek, the penultimate major battle of the war, he treats them to a field banquet with all the best food he can muster, shares his blanket with a Southern general that night, and And when his troops are marching, and it's in the book, when his cavalry division is ready to go off in the morning to further pursue Lee, he sets up a big display for all these Southern generals who've had to surrender at Sailor's Creek and all the Southern men. He calls them up to the side of the road, gives a cavalry parade in their honor, and has his regimental band play Dixie and Bonnie Blue Flag. And it's so, here's a man who 24 hours before was doing his best to slaughter these people. And the next day, you know, they're all chummy, and they're playing Dixie for his Union bands, playing Dixie for the Confederate prisoners, and the Confederate generals cheer George Armstrong Custer. It's just, I mean, and so many of them knew each other from West Point or from the Frontier Service. So it not only is brother against brother, but it's old friend against old friend.
Mm.
And my gosh, you got to see them as human beings, not just as marble or bronze statues.
Right. One thing that is important, and I didn't really know this, or I don't remember knowing this until I visited the Abraham Lincoln Museum in Springfield, Illinois this past summer for the first time. And in a really interesting display they have there about the Civil War, in which it plays out in animation as we kind of watch a map of the southern part of the United States and different battles appear. And at the bottom, there is a running tab of casualties both north and south. And it was only when I watched that that I realized that the north lost more soldiers than the south. For as much as there was a certain superiority in certain respects and a certain, perhaps now we think of as inevitability about the Union victory, that in fact it was a very painfully costly conflict on both sides, and the North lost more men. And that helps us understand why General Grant was so desperate for the conflict to end, for Lee not to be allowed to allow it to stretch out even longer.
Yeah, Grant understands the basic truth of war, that the quicker you can end it, the less suffering there is. And so his 1864 campaign, called the Overland Campaign, that gets him to Petersburg, is really bloody. But he's seen how for years that we'd fight a battle and everybody could go back to their corner of the ring, get, you know, regroup, go back and fight another battle, go back to their corner of the ring. And he knew to end it, you had to be relentless. You had to bring all the power, the manpower, the wealth, the industrial power, the railroads, all the strength to bear upon the South, and to do it relentlessly. And that's what he did. But yes, Union casualties were definitely higher overall for two reasons. You could argue two or three or four, but the two salient ones for me are, one, strategically, the North is on the offensive, and the attacker almost always takes higher casualties, except in certain surprise attacks. But the other thing is, the Union armies are a lot bigger, and again, most people die from disease. And so if you look at the casualty counts, they don't fully understand sanitation yet, but they're cracking the code. And so many people die of dysentery, of typhoid, of smallpox, of measles. They're dying of measles in camp. And, oh, by the way, the kind of thing we don't like to talk about, there are, for the Northern and Southern armies, there are special clinics established for venereal disease victims. Prostitution was widespread, and no antibiotics. Hey, not even aspirin, by the way. And so it's fought by human beings, and they are flawed. They were not perfect heroes. The greatest differentiation between we in 2017 and those people in the 1860s wasn't technological differences. They were living in a revolutionary age of technology. The telegraph, the railroad, the steamship, the mass market newspapers, distances collapsing. For them, their times were as revolutionary as ours are for us. The difference was profound religious belief, much more pervasive and literal than it is today. And, you know, you wonder how those men could stand up there just at 50 yards apart and shoot each other for an hour in the open. And they really had a belief in the afterlife and something to come in a more literal and visceral sense than we do today. And that's not the only answer, but it's part of it. I mean, these generals, they really do. I mean, they're men. Some are corrupt and wild scoundrels. Others are fervent Christians, North and South. Again, they're complicated. You have to ask yourself, who was this individual, and not just lump them all together.
Right, and sweeping generalizations. In our final couple of minutes, I want to ask you, because your book, of course, is so timely, in that some of the old tensions of the Civil War are actually with us today in more vivid fashion than has been the case in some time. I wonder if you have anything to say about some of this recent controversy, particularly regarding the removal or replacing of Confederate monuments. How would you have us think about this and discuss this?
I would ask, which monument? There are Confederate-era monuments, Confederate monuments that should be taken down. Jefferson Davis, president of the Confederacy, was a rabid slaveholder, a believer in slavery forever, a primary driver of secession. Nothing good I could say about that man. When it gets to the military, it's different. There is one Confederate general, if there's any statue of him anywhere, I'd take it down. That's Nathan Bedford Forrest. In his civilian life, he was a slave dealer. In the Civil War, he committed atrocities against black troops. After the Civil War, he was a founder of the Ku Klux Klan. We don't need statues of him. But let's look at the others. So many of the Confederate generals were men who, had been to West Point. As I mentioned, they were opposed to secession. Robert E. Lee, Jubal Early, Thomas Jonathan, Stonewall Jackson, opposed to secession. But they had to fight for their states, they felt. They couldn't turn on their neighbors. It was an anguished decision for these guys, particularly for Lee and Jackson. And they didn't want this war. And remember, a trigger for a lot of these people is when Lincoln calls for volunteers to reestablish the army, the Union. That means Lincoln is going to invade the South. And that's what a lot of them make their final decision. No, we've got to defend our states. Now, so there are some individuals we should never have statues of. But let's look at some others. Stonewall Jackson's a classic example. Thomas Jonathan Jackson grew up poor in Western Virginia, got an education at West Point, serves in the Mexican War. Now, here's Jackson in the 1850s. He's a VMI professor in Lexington, Virginia. He is known as a great friend of blacks, free blacks and slaves. He pushes the limits of Virginia law against his neighbor's opposition. He establishes a Sunday school for free blacks and slaves. It's very successful. He breaks Virginia law to teach blacks to read because he believes they have a right to read and they should be able to read the Bible. He's a devout Presbyterian. And he's known as such a friend to blacks that at one point a slave in Lexington who's about to be sold south into the deep south, the cotton culture where slavery is at its most brutal, he begs Jackson to buy him. And Jackson, on his professor's salary, scrapes together the money. He buys the slave, immediately turns him loose to earn his living. The man goes to work as a waiter in the local hotel, saves up his money, pays his debt to Jackson, and goes free. Now, is he really fighting for slavery? Absolutely not. Stonewall Jackson is a man whose statue should not come down. I'll tell you also, the statues of private soldiers, simple Confederate soldiers in all those small towns in the South, they're not statues to slavery. They're statues to the local boys who went off to war. Again, let's talk about specific statues, not blanket generalizations. Yes, some should come down, others not. And it's a truth that, victorious people like the North love their heroes, but defeated people need heroes. And you'll hear arguments saying, well, those statues of Southerners, they didn't even go up till the late 19th century or early 20th century. Because the South was poor. They were broken and devastated. They didn't have the money. And, I just want people to understand how humanly complex it was. Okay, you want to take statues down? It always worries me particularly because I am, I'm someone whose professional life was spent studying the Soviet Union and Russia. And I see that you're rewriting history. This is pure Stalin.
Ralph Peters, the author of Judgment at Appomattox, thank you so much for your time.
And the time now is exactly 8:40. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD HD.
For part two of today's morning show, in light of last night's premiere of the first episode in the Vietnam War documentary series by Ken Burns, I thought it would be interesting to go into the WGTD archives in order to replay for you a portion of a conversation which I had with U.S. Army veteran Louis Sorley, a graduate of West Point and the author of several fascinating books about Vietnam, including a book called Westmoreland, The General Who Lost Vietnam, which examines the career of William Childs Westmoreland and the way in which his career ended under such a dark cloud of controversy and even disgrace because of the way that he led American forces during the Vietnam War conflict. Your prologue begins with this sentence. The premise of this study is that unless and until we understand William Childs Westmoreland, we will never understand fully what happened to us in Vietnam or why. Can you explain a little more about what is behind those words with which you begin your book?
Yes, and thanks for starting with that, because that's the key point, of course. General Westmoreland was a very conventional, even pedestrian officer. He did not get the benefit of the Army's great school system. Army officers, and probably other service officers too, get a wonderful regimen of repeated opportunities for higher education as they go through their careers. Westmoreland served for 36 years, and the only formal education he got was a one-month course in mess management offered by the Cooks and Bakers School in Hawaii when he was a lieutenant, and parachute school after World War II. He missed out on the Army, on the Army's Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, did not attend the Army War College at Carlisle Barracks, and perversely was rather proud of that. He said he'd never read the book. When he got to Vietnam, he was faced with, as we now all know, an amazingly complex situation, one that would have challenged the best educated and most insightful commander. And frankly, he just wasn't up to it. But he stayed in command for 4 years, something we can explore if you wish. And during that 4 years, he hewed doggedly to the one approach to the conduct of the war he had begun with. He decided to fight a war of attrition. The way he fought that war was through large unit operations called search and destroy operations. The objective was to kill as many of the enemy as possible. Therefore, the measure of merit in such an approach to the war was body count. And Westmoreland was determined that if he could inflict enough casualties on the enemy, they would lose heart, give up, cease their aggression against the South, and go home again. But year after year, and asking for more and more U.S. forces, which for a long time he got, he continued to kill enemy in large numbers, but it didn't get him anywhere. The enemy just kept sending replacements down more and more. So how many he killed didn't seem to matter. Basically, he was on a treadmill. And until we understand that and his inability or unwillingness to even consider, much less adopt, a different approach to the war, it seems, you know, very difficult to understand what happened to us there.
Until I read your book, I was really mystified by what I had seen in a couple of different reviews which talked about your book and, of course, other accounts about General Westmoreland, painting this picture of a man of some gifts and showing some promise. I mean, a life that began well with
Yep.
some exciting successes and which seemed pointed towards ultimately a life of essentially complete success. And then, of course, comes Vietnam. And so, you know, just to kind of hear that, you wonder, well, did people misunderstand that great promise, or what happened? And then at the end of your prologue, in a sense, you really spell out what ultimately we learn in the book. You write, Westmoreland's strengths eventually propelled him to a level beyond his understanding and abilities. That is, I mean, the fact that he was an Eagle Scout and all these other successes early in life, that does not mean that they prepared him to enjoy similar success when it came to as complicated a challenge as that which he faced in Vietnam.
I think that's exactly right. If General Westmoreland had retired, let us say, as a major general after commanding the 101st Airborne Division for 2 years, I think we would remember him as a very fine officer who did very well. It's only when he went to higher levels and more complicated situations that his limitations became so apparent. And I say near the end of the book something this effect, that I think we would view General Westmoreland with far more sympathy if it had not been for the fact that a principal reason he got to the levels he did was his unrelenting self-promotion, which was the reason why, primary reason why, let's say, that he got to the levels at which he was in over his head.
Hmm. I appreciated how your book takes great care to explain some of the bedrock principles behind how he guided our efforts in Vietnam. And in fact, you devote an entire chapter to the matter of search and destroy. You've touched on this already. Could you say a word about why General Westmoreland believed this to be the best option? And in some respects, the best of a limited array of options in terms of how we should fight in Vietnam.
Yes, I would be glad to address that because it's key to why he didn't succeed. General Westmoreland, as I said, was a conventionally minded person. His World War II experience had been in one kind of war. He gets to Vietnam. It becomes apparent that if we're not going to let the South Vietnamese go down the drain in the early days, we're going to have to send some troops there to shore them up until they can become stronger. So we begin to do that, and it, very early on, it becomes apparent that General Westmoreland decides, rather than shoring up the South Vietnamese, he's going to take these U.S. forces and win the war himself, hand the country back over to the South Vietnamese, and come home in glory. And so he bends all his efforts to that. There were two things among many, the two most outstanding things wrong with that approach. One, we've already discussed, it didn't matter how many of the enemy he killed, they just kept sending more, and so that didn't work. And secondly, the things that he ignored. He did not build up the South Vietnamese, far from it. They were left to fight with cast-off World War II U.S. weaponry during a time when the enemy, the communists, were being given the very best of equipment by their sponsors, the Soviet Union and Communist China, most notably the wonderful AK-47 assault rifle. And so the poor South Vietnamese not only ignored but outgunned for all of Westmoreland's time in command. The sweeps that he favored, the big unit operations, battalions, ganged one on another, or sometimes even divisions, took place mostly in the deep jungle, far from where the people were, and consequently didn't do a thing to help the people in the villages, and they were dominated by this communist covert infrastructure that was using terror and coercion to keep them under control. So not only was what he was doing in the jungles killing enemy, not achieving the desired objective, but while he's out there doing that, the poor people in the rural South Vietnam are still under the enemy's domination. So either side of it you want to look at, it wasn't working. Now, it's important to know that General Westmoreland was offered a viable alternative. In Washington, General Harold K. Johnson, the Army Chief of Staff, the same 4 years Westmoreland was in Vietnam, cranked up a major study early on. It was known as PROVN, P-R-O-V-N. And that study examined what was being done in the situation and said, what Westmoreland is doing is not working, and it cannot work. And the main thing, reason why it couldn't work, was it was ignoring the war in the villages that we've talked about. So that was briefed to Westmoreland. Of course, he rejected it out of hand, and so he continued, and this is key, he was allowed to continue for 4 years with the approach that we've been discussing. But when he finally was replaced by General Creighton Abrams, who had been Vice Chief of Staff when that study was done and had signed off on it when he took command in June of 1968 and stayed for 4 years, he adopted right away the proven approach, and before long things went much better. General Fred Wyand, who was a senior commander in Vietnam, corps-level commander at the time, said the tactics changed within 15 minutes of Abrams taking command. And instead of the search-and-destroy operations that Westmoreland had favored, now we had clear-and-hold operations sited much closer to the population so as to protect them and make the enemy come to you and fight on your terms instead of the other way around.
It's so interesting to hear about the concerns and reservations that many officers had about this whole notion of search and destroy. I mean, the name might be catchy, but as you've just outlined, it proved not to be effective. One of the people you quote is Brigadier General Ellis Williamson saying in "I hope that we have conducted our last search and destroy operation. I am thoroughly convinced that running into the jungle with a lot of people without a fixed target is a lot of effort, a lot of physical energy expended. A major portion of our effort evaporates into the air." I really appreciate the way he says that, because it helps us understand also the mounting sense of frustration and bewilderment that was the experience of so many of our soldiers on the ground in Vietnam involved in these search and destroy missions.
Yes, and poor General Williamson, he was a fine officer, and he went out in May of 1965, so this is at the very beginning of our introduction of ground forces with the 173rd Airborne Brigade, a top-notch outfit. And that quotation from him is spot on. He used to write what were called combat notes, and he'd issue them to his people in his unit, and sometimes he'd send them to other people, one of the other people being General Harold K. Johnson. And General Johnson hadn't gotten a combat notes from Williamson for a while, so he sent him a message. He said, if you've stopped sending the combat notes to me, start. If you've stopped writing them, start again. General Johnson found this right on, because the proven study that he had conducted was completely congruent with what Williamson had seen on the ground. But that continued. Here's Williamson early on. In July of 65, we start sending divisions size units out there, and eventually we build up to where we've got corps level headquarters as well. There's a vignette. I'll try to shorten it because I know your time is limited. But then Lieutenant General Fred Wyand commanded a field force, corps level headquarters, a couple of years later, and he's approached by two reporters, and he talks very candidly to them off the record, and he says, "I've beat up the same Viet Cong division three times now, and they just go back over the borders. You know, we allowed sanctuaries across the borders into Laos and Cambodia, and they refit and come back in. Then I have to do the same thing to them over again." He says, "We're not getting anywhere." R.W. Apple, the famous Johnny Apple, wrote a great piece on this for the New York Times, and he said, "This is a stalemate." This is in 67. Westmoreland's been there 3 years now. A stalemate. And in Washington, they went ballistic. The president and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Wheeler, sent a message out to Westmoreland and said, "My God, what's this all about?" Westmoreland said confidently, "No general of mine would ever say that." But one of his generals had, and not till much later did that general allow himself to be identified, not until after Westmoreland had passed from this life. But then they were able to say, "This was General Fred Wyand." And Wyand was a wonderfully fine officer and full of credibility, and he was exactly right. Mm-hmm.
Another chapter of your book deals with the matter of body count and the fact that if this was all about the numbers, this war of attrition,
than the numbers really counted. And the trouble was, of course, the ultimate distortion of numbers, that in a sense the numbers should have told us if we were succeeding or failing, but the numbers also were important for the sense of our commitment in Vietnam and what discouraging numbers would do to our commitment. I mean, in many respects, that's as crucial as anything, the fact that these numbers meant two different things, and when you began to distort the numbers, you were distorting everything.
That is exactly right, and there were at least two major things wrong with body count as a measure of merit. One we've already touched on. It didn't really matter how many the enemy killed because their willingness to send replacements was unlimited. Someone, I think, David Halberstam maybe once wrote that we were fighting the birth rate of a nation, and so that wasn't going to achieve the objectives that General Westmoreland thought it would. The other part of it, which you allude to, is the body count was a I don't see any other way to say this, a corrupt and corrupting influence on our own chain of command. There was enormous pressure, especially in certain headquarters, to report high body counts, so inevitably some became inflated. And so then, even if it had been a viable measure of merit, it was no longer reliable. And a wonderful man, Ambassador Ellsworth Bunker, came on the scene in March of 67 and served for 6 years as head of our embassy there. And one of his most basic conclusions was body count is not a good measure of progress in a war like this.
This is tied up in something which came to be known as the Progress Offensive. It was really a PR campaign back home engineered by the Johnson administration. And I suppose at the time, caught in this difficult situation, it must have made some kind of sense. But we read about it now, and it's so disturbing. I mean, on all kinds of different levels, that so much of this effort at this point in time became about PR.
Yes, it was, and General Westmoreland lent himself to that effort with great enthusiasm. He claimed then and later in his memoirs that he was an unwilling participant, but all of his senior associates said, no, he really liked to be in the spotlight. He really liked to be dealing at the higher levels. He'd come back to Vietnam after one of those trips to the United States, just buoyed up and on cloud nine, said his associate, General Bruce Palmer. So the problem here was, okay, he's going back to the United States three times during 1967. No commander of a major expeditionary force before that had ever done that. Peter Braestrup said Westmoreland took the king's shilling and it cost him his reputation. He went to the AP editor's luncheon. He went on Meet the Press. He went to the National Press Club. He spoke to a joint session of Congress, and he said things like, I've never been more encouraged during my almost 4 years in Vietnam, and things like, we've reached the point where the end is beginning to come into sight, and things like, the enemy's hopes are bankrupt. And his last appearance was in November. In January, the enemy launches its Tet Offensive of 1968, and people see this on their television sets, and a lot of them conclude that either General Westmoreland hadn't known what he was talking about, all those things he said when he was back in the States, or he hadn't leveled with the American people. And it's hard for me to say which is the more devastating criticism.
Lewis Sorley's book is called Westmoreland, The General Who Lost Vietnam, published by Mariner Books. We'll be playing more of that conversation and also my conversation with Lewis Sorley about his book, A Better War, at some point during the next 2 weeks on The Morning Show. Tomorrow, you'll hear my interview with James Glick, whose fascinating new book is called Time Travel and explores the way in which human beings over the millennia have looked at the future. It includes a careful study of the great classic, The Time Machine by H.G. Wells. Also, we'll talk with Steve Rogstad about the tour of historic places that is coming up this weekend. On Wednesday, we look forward to a return visit from Dr. Art Sear from Carthage College. On Thursday, I'll be speaking with three representatives of Kenosha's